Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A year and a half ago, not too many people had even heard the word subprime. Back then, Ben Bernanke was saying the mortgage crisis would be contained. This spring, Bear Stearns was still alive. A month ago, the government wasn't in the business of mortgage finance or insurance. So please, somebody, remind me again how this happened. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity, online at us.areva.com. And by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 17th of September. Glad to have you with us. Today is, interestingly enough, Constitution Day, the 221st anniversary of the signing of that document. I'm pretty sure there's nothing in there about the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve setting themselves up in private business, though. Sounds kind of strange, but with the Fed's bailout of the insurance company AIG last night, that's effectively where we are. Fortunately, you don't have to go all the way back to the Founding Fathers to understand how we got here. You just need to remember the words of a man almost as revered.
The Federal Open Market Committee stands ready to maintain a highly accommodative stance of policy for as long as it takes to achieve a return to satisfactory economic performance.
Alan Greenspan, of course, saying in that way that he has, that he's going to keep interest rates low as long as it takes. When he gave that congressional testimony 5 years ago, he was about to lower the Fed short-term interest rate to 1% and leave it there for more than a year. That, in and of itself, wasn't a bad thing. It's what people did with all that cheap money that's gotten us into trouble. They borrowed. They borrowed a lot. And then they got creative, using things like collateralized debt obligations to bundle risky mortgages into something they could sell off in the markets. But when the value of the houses behind those mortgages began dropping, well, here's financial analyst Peter Cohen.
Nobody knows what's in these bundles of mortgages, and they have a very, very low value because nobody can open them up and figure out which ones are paying and which ones are not paying. It's like Superman trying to look inside of a box that's wrapped in lead. You just can't see inside.
If there's one thing we've learned over the past year and a half, when the markets don't know what's inside, they just stop. They stop lending. They stop buying. Nobody trusts anybody. And presto, a credit crisis. There's an argument to be made, and lots of really smart people have made it, that all those financial innovations, things like CDOs, were inevitable. That once you had basically free money thanks to Alan Greenspan and a crowd on Wall Street that's always looking for an edge, abuses were bound to happen. That what we've got here is a failure of regulation. Kathleen Keast at the Center for Responsible Lending calls it a culture of anti-regulation.
Well, I think the mantras were, we know what we're doing, and government will stifle access to credit, and we don't want to do that.
Even today, after all the economy's been through in the past year and a half, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson still isn't convinced regulation's the answer. Here he is from 2 days ago, the day Lehman Brothers went under and Merrill Lynch was bought out by Bank of America.
Well, I think there's got to be a balance between regulation and market discipline. You can't rely on one to solve the problem.
The Dow Industrials disciplined itself down 500 points that day, and since then, of course, the government has added insurance to its business portfolio. It's not likely many people would have said this is where we'd wind up after Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke said the crisis would be contained. For most of that time, the tone of the financial markets has been cautious, with occasional moments of doom and gloom, like during the demise of Bear Stearns back in March. But a couple of weeks ago, things somehow changed, and not for the better either. Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon's been looking at the calendar since the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Hi, Bob.
I'm still with you, Kai.
That's right. You're back, as a matter of fact. I understand how, 10 days can change history, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why these past 10 days, though?
Well, there didn't seem to be any dramatic trigger with the takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But that apparently did set off shockwaves, something of a chain reaction. In a couple of ways, really, we'd been hearing steady assurances from the CEOs of these firms not to worry, things were under control. But when the government took them over, that action really spoke much louder than words. Investors seemed to take that as an official sign from the government that it really was as bad as it seemed. And that starts raising questions about who else is harboring or even hiding big new losses. What might that say about the reassurances that others have been offering? Mm-hmm. You know, investors started having nasty flashbacks to those rosy words that we were hearing from CEOs like John Thane at Merrill Lynch. Remember his conference call with investors at the beginning of the year.
We have great long-term prospects. As I look out into 2008, I'm very optimistic about our ability to perform for our shareholders.
Great long-term prospects, says a man whose company was just bought by Bank of America. Right?
Exactly. And he kept up that drumbeat of reassuring words all year long until finally analysts started calling him on it a few weeks ago, essentially saying, look, enough words. Where are the results here? Same with Lehman Brothers. The CEO kept trying to buy time. And finally, investors just ran out of patience. I guess you could say that there's really a thin line between buying time and just plain deception.
Investors got sick and tired of that. They started bidding down the stock. Is that what then has caused this 10 days we've had?
Well, that's not all that's been playing out. I talked to one Wall Street veteran today who told me this really has become not so much a credit crisis because there's plenty of money out there to lend. You know, the Fed's been flooding the market with lots of cheap cash. The problem now is a solvency problem, or at least a perceived problem. We've got money to lend, but we don't trust your balance sheet. They trusted what Fannie and Freddie were telling them. They got burned. That meant Lehman Brothers and AIG, they were already highly leveraged, living on borrowed money, couldn't keep borrowing.
Is this then, as you said, all perception? I mean, they perceived these things?
Well, it's not all perception. There is some very real questioning of the fundamentals now, and one big one in particular. We haven't been focusing a lot on the old story of mortgage defaults and foreclosures, but it's worth paying attention to the increasingly rapid rate of defaults. They're up 112% from this time last year. So it's a crisis of confidence, yes, but it's rooted in some very real problems.
Let me turn your premise on the head, though, that it was the CEOs of these companies who were buying time, and then finally they ran out of time. Is it now the government, having bailed out AIG, having bailed out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are they now, Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke, buying time?
That is true to some degree. Remember when we chatted here earlier this week, I said the trick is landing this thing gradually without crashing, but you don't want to drag it out so slowly that you really introduce some torture here. Something else I mentioned then, we seem to get some clarity with the events on Monday. Well, now with this very bold action with the takeover of AIG, essentially, we're back to Wall Street asking what's going on and why now? So we're back to the fear of the unknown.
The unknown. And we know, of course, how the markets feel about that. Marketplace's senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
Look no further than Wall Street today if you want to know exactly how much markets don't like the unknown. The Dow dropped 450 points. The NASDAQ and the S&P got pummeled as well. You want to know what was up, though? Think traditional safe havens and investors looking for places to park their cash. Gold had a banner day. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The government's been throwing cash around willy-nilly to do all these bailouts, Bear Stearns, AIG, Fannie and Freddie. And they don't even count the hundreds of billions of dollars in short-term cash loans to keep things flowing inside the banking system. Pretty soon, to paraphrase here, you're talking real money. But where's all that cash coming from? And how often can Bernanke and Paulson keep going back to the well? Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story from Washington.
To help pay for these bailouts, the government sells securities. And right now, there's plenty of demand because those securities are considered safe in the midst of all the turmoil. For example, today, the Treasury Department auctioned $45 billion in short-term IOUs. They'll be bought back in only 35 days. Ward McCarthy, the managing director of Stone and McCarthy Research Associates, says investors snapped them up at some very attractive interest rates for the government.
There were some people who actually bid zero just to know that they would get their money back in 35 days. They were willing to lend the money to the Treasury for free, knowing that they wouldn't lose it in the stock market or that they wouldn't have it be held by another financial institution that could undergo some difficulties.
Is there a limit to the government's largesse? Not as long as people are confident the government will pay its bills, says Wharton Business School professor Jeremy Siegel.
The government cannot run out of money. Go into your wallet and take a look at what you got in. It's called Federal Reserve Notes. Those are under control of the Federal Reserve. Do you notice that they don't say they are backed by gold? They are not backed by silver. They don't have to have anything behind them except the full faith and confidence of the government.
And in the AIG case, the government might actually earn money. It's demanding an 11% interest rate on its two-year loan and holds nearly 80% of the insurance company as collateral. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wherever the money that John was talking about is going to come from, it is not going to come without strings attached and lots of them. Congress has already promised hearings, and you can pretty much bet on new rules and regulations for the financial industry once the elections are over. Commentator David Frum sees the point that what's needed to fix things is the strong hand of government. He just disagrees.
Okay, this is audacity. From every side, we suddenly hear people calling for more regulation of financial markets. The calamity on Wall Street has brought to public attention the frightening risk-taking of firms like Lehman Brothers, which lent money against assets at a rate of 35 to 1. Something must be done. The government must put a stop to this. But in the excitement of scapegoat hunting, something important is forgotten. Wall Street was doing exactly what the government wanted it to do. Almost all the exotic credit instruments now wreaking havoc trace back to the simplest of all assets, the single-family home. Insurance giant AIG, for example, held almost $100 billion in mortgage-backed securities when the market began to fall last year, and almost one-third of those securities were based on subprime loans. The United States takes pride in high home ownership rates. And over the past decade, administrations of both parties encouraged ever looser lending standards in order to push the home ownership rate higher and higher still. You don't have to be a Wall Street wizard to predict what comes next. When you are extending mortgages to the 65th, 66th, and 67th percentiles of creditworthiness, you are going to encounter more and more people with low and variable incomes, no down payment, and uncertain credit history. To serve this population, you're going to have to shift far away from the old-fashioned 30% down, 30-year fixed amortizing loan. And over a decade, politicians and regulators prodded and pulled mortgage writers to do just that. The mortgage writers happily obliged. After all, they weren't going to keep those loans. Wall Street would repackage and resell the loans to investors worldwide. One loan might go bad, but multiply that loan by a million and then subdivide it again into a million parts, and you had a bond that looked, well, as safe as houses, as the British say. And after all, there was a government guarantee, wasn't there? This crisis was enabled and intensified by government. So how does it make sense to say that the solution to the crisis is still more government?
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. You can come on back to us with your comments. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. In Beijing today, the government announced three babies have died due to tainted infant formula. More than 6,000 have suffered kidney damage. It's a story that, for now, seems far from North America. But with Chinese factories feeling the pressure of the global economic slowdown, it could be a sign of things to come. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from the heart of industrial China, Guangdong Province.
Chinese investigators probed 109 milk companies and found 20% sold products with melamine. Today, it also emerged that tainted dairy powder may have been exported from China, not to the U.S., but to poor countries like Myanmar, Bangladesh, and Burundi. The leading theory is someone in the milk chain took out the expensive protein and stuck in a cheap chemical instead. Product substitution. The same thing happened last year with Chinese pet food and toxic toys. In every case, it's a cost cutter, a response to economic pressures.
Increase those pressures, and certainly you're going to have increased negative results.
David Dayton runs Silk Road International, a manufacturing consultancy. He says Chinese factories are getting squeezed by rising labor costs and by dwindling orders from the U.S. and Europe. So these manufacturers are tempted to cheat.
To say that there will be corners cut, there'll be quality fade, the quality of products fading more quickly in a lot of areas, I think is pretty safe to say.
The margin squeeze shows up at workshops all over southern China. The Wind Taifu Printing Company turns out magazines and packaging for multinationals. Manager Ren Ming says a Darwinian shakeout is underway.
Factories and consumers are clashing over profit margins, and those factories that can't survive will go bankrupt. Our entire industry is having its deck reshuffled.
If factories bend the rules, their multinational customers are supposed to catch the flaws. But David Dayton says it doesn't always work that way. The quality control inspectors often show up at a plant and say,
our goal is to come in and have a successful inspection. So we're going to tell you before we come in which factory we want to see, and we're going to tell you what information we do and don't want, and we're going to come in, spend a half hour, check the boxes, and go home.
Dayton says the system being the way it is, he won't be surprised if more substandard products end up on American shelves. In Guangzhou, southern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, a price war over cell phones in a place far, far away.
VTunes and MMS services are free of charge. Don't miss this opportunity to try out our entertaining services.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh my, bloodbath doesn't quite cover it now, does it? The Dow Industrials plummeted 4% today, 449 points to close at 10,609. The Nasdaq sliced off 4.9%, 109 points to end at 2,098. The S&P 500 lost 57 points. That's 4.7% to finish at 1156. As you might have imagined, financial stocks were pounded amid fears that the growing credit crisis would claim more victims. Morgan Stanley, one of two independent Wall Street brokerages still standing, plunged more than 24%. The other one, Goldman Sachs, sheared off nearly 14%. Citigroup unloaded close to 11%. J.P. Morgan Chase gave up 12.2%. General Electric, the world's third biggest company, fell 6.2%. Think GE Capital there. All that fear made investors greedy for commodities and for precious metals in particular. Gold rose $70 to close at $850 an ounce. Newport Mining, the largest U.S. gold producer, rose 9.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.41%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Cleveland Clinic, working to redefine healthcare and the patient experience with the new Miller Family Pavilion and Glickman Tower. More at meetthebuildings.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its leading economic indicators for August. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee discusses recent bank failures and the response of regulators. And the House Small Business Committee holds a hearing on making health care reform work for small business. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. When the economy gets wobbly, everything gets shaky. Even businesses you might think are recession-proof, like pro sports. The New York Jets announced a deal with ticket seller StubHub today. The team's going to be auctioning off the best seats in its new stadium to the highest bidders. A lot of sports are looking for ways to make a quick buck this season. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell is warning the league's not going to be bringing in as much money as originally predicted. Terry Lefton at the Sports Business Journal got his hands on the commissioner's memo saying as much. Terry, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
I always thought until I read your article that the NFL was the best business model in all of pro sports, and now you're telling me that's not true.
Well, I'm not disputing the model. I'm just saying that in terms of new business and many businesses, if there's no growth, they consider it an epic tragedy. They're not having a lot of growth, and they're having budget shortfalls in terms of expected new business. Their old business is still good. They're still the biggest and most profitable sports property in this nation. And so I'm not feeling particularly sorry for them, but it is interesting that you see a memo from the commissioner warning of budget shortfalls, and he kind of hints at layoffs but doesn't quite say that they're layoffs.
Let's go down some of their revenue streams. The first one, the biggest one, has to be television, and isn't that guaranteed?
Right. Most of their biggest revenue streams are contractually obligated, such as TV. So here you're talking about selling their own network, the NFL network. You're talking about selling advertising on that network, and you're talking about corporate sponsorship revenues, which are in the hundreds of millions. Now, I can't remember them starting a season in recent past without a new corporate sponsor, and they did not start the season with a new corporate sponsor. So I think my point in writing this article wasn't so much to tweak them as to say, well, if the biggest and best and most profitable sports property in the nation, i.e. the NFL, is having problems turning over new business, well, what does that say about the AAA team in Portland or a soccer team in Salt Lake City? They're really all having a hard time generating new business, and that's because of the economic squeeze we're in.
Well, what about the areas where sports advertising typically gets most of its money? What are they doing?
Two of the biggest ones are financial services and the auto industry, and both are having big hurts right now. So that's impacting them in terms of advertising and sponsorships, both at the top with the NFL, and I think every club right now is having problems getting more money out of that category or signing new people in that category. You can't really overstate the case because cars and banks and credit cards and other financial service ventures are big, big contributors to the sports economy.
In sports, it kind of gets personal when people don't make as much money as they thought. These teams, for the most part, are owned by individuals. Do you get the sense that these owners are going to the commissioner and saying, hey, Roger, come on, you got to do it for us?
I think it's the other way around. This memo that I got from some people that weren't really happy that a guy that the commissioner that makes $12 million a year was talking about pulling in the strings a little. But this memo that I got was sent to every NFL league employee. That's a number of hundred. When he sends something out to every league employee, I'm sure he knows that that's going to get to the clubs. So I think that's one of his way of softening the blow that, hey, you know, we told you that we're going to have these revenues at the end of the year. We're not. I'm sure he's told all his owners already, but now he's told everybody at every level.
How much of this, though, in light of that, is bureaucratic infighting and how much is substance?
No, I think it's substantive. I think, you know, that, as I said, when the economy goes south, marketing budgets, rightly or wrongly, are often the first to go. And I think this is a sign of that. This year is a little bit of a false economy overall because you've got both the election and the Olympics pumping an awful lot of money into sports and media in general. Next year, I believe it will get worse because you don't have those things propping it up.
Terry Lefton, editor-at-large at the Sports Business Journal. Terry, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Let's take a break for a minute here and go someplace where the financial events of the past couple of weeks haven't really made much of a dent in the national conversation. A place that measures its health by gross national happiness, not GDP. Bhutan is about as far away from Wall Street as you can get. The tiny Asian kingdom of 700,000 has had television for less than 10 years. Cell phones arrived even later. But Lisa Napoli explains things are changing, and Bhutan is experiencing its own brand of business upheaval.
Until a couple months ago, if you wanted a cell phone in Bhutan, you only had one choice. B-Mobile, owned and operated by the government. Then, this past spring, a privately owned competitor was let in. And in this peaceful Buddhist country, a cell phone war erupted.
Tashi Cell, keep in touch.
Tashi Cell debuted with a capitalist flourish few people in this poor Himalayan nation have ever experienced. Banners flew on the streets of the capital city, and roadside stands were set up to lure customers in. Glossy ads ran in the newspapers. Then came the bombshell offer. Unlimited free calls for 10 weeks if you're calling Tashi to Tashi.
So we have to try, whatever we can, in any ways we can, to get a customer base.
That's Tashi Sering of Tashi Cell.
I thought this free scheme would work because we are basically creating a habit for the people to use mobile services.
Tashi Suring knew that in a place where people can barely afford the $2 charge to reload a phone card, a free scheme would be a wonder. And it was. Monks, teenagers, old men, suddenly everybody seemed to have a phone attached to their ear. People started dialing randomly just to see who'd pick up. Of course, this created some problems.
Tashi says it always says connection error.
That's my friend Nawang, who, like many people trying to reach me on my Tashi cell, complained that she could never get through. To deal with clogged lines, Tashi started dumping chatty callers mid-yap after just a couple minutes. Meanwhile, B-Mobile has been suffering. Managing Director Yeshi Tazge says she's lost almost a third of her customer base as the Tashi subscriber numbers have swelled.
The scheme that Tashi has launched is really, like, you know, creating havoc with our business, actually.
And B-Mobile can't cut its rates to compete with Tashi for 6 months. The Bhutanese equivalent of the Federal Communications Commission called for the price-slashing ban. It wants to give Tashi a chance to get a foothold in the market. B-Mobile's done what it can by giving bonus talk time and new services away.
B-Tunes and MMS services are free of charge. Don't miss this opportunity to try out our entertaining services.
Meanwhile, the prospect of a battle for consumers once the ban expires has cell phone addicts like Kinga Galtzen pretty excited.
Yeah, up until now, because of the monopoly, we've all been suffering. So, I mean, it's finally time that the consumer actually is king for a little while.
And in a place where a monarch had absolute rule until earlier this year, that seems a fitting development. In Thimphu, Bhutan, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, although to be honest, what I'm telling you now might well be stealing from tomorrow's headlines at the rate things are going. There are a couple of reports out there this afternoon that potential buyers are sniffing around Washington Mutual. The Seattle-based bank lost $3.3 billion last quarter, fired its CEO a couple of weeks ago. The names being mentioned as interested in a deal aren't really surprises. Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, HSBC, and Citigroup. Also, the New York Times says this afternoon Morgan Stanley is considering a merger with Wachovia. But the only thing to say here is we'll be telling you about that tomorrow. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 449 points, 4%. The NASDAQ lost 109 points, 4.9%. The S&P 500 dropped 57 points, 4.7% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, you know, you'd think everything that has happened so far on Wall Street would at least give us a clue as to what the future holds. Ha! Not a chance. Tune in tomorrow as we continue our coverage of the Wall Street Shakedown. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for being with us.
American Public Media.